We have two opening presentations. The first is going to be by John Nectarline, who is a partner and co-leader in Sidley Austin's communications regulatory practice. And he also previously served as the general counsel of the FTC and the deputy general counsel of the FCC. Another presentation following John's is going to be by Carl Shapiro, who was introduced earlier this morning, and I won't read his bio again, but he is a professor at the University of California at Berkeley and served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General, head of the Economic Analysis Group at the Department of Justice on two occasions. So John will start us off.
Thank you, Derek. I'm very happy to be here. I'm going to begin with a little history lesson and a riddle. And the riddle is, think of a company, past or present, that uses scale, vertical integration, and innovation, transform retailing, undersells its rivals, puts many of them out of business, and whose very success prompts calls for radical changes to the nation's antitrust laws. The answer to this question is not Amazon. Amazon actually has only a small fraction of the retail sales today is Walmart. The answer instead is this company, A&P, which people my age or older will remember from the 20th century. It was a powerhouse supermarket chain that by 1929 had really come to dominate retailing in America in a way that no other company had done before. And at this point, I'm going to make two disclosures and a disclaimer. The first disclosure is that the presentation I'm about to give is based on a paper that my colleague Tim Muris and I wrote that was funded by Amazon. The second disclosure is I worked at A&P as a teenager. That little grocery store, I spent two summers working as a bag boy in the A&P. The disclaimer is I will not let all views I express here today are my own, not those of any client or former employer. So how did A&P do it? How did it come to dominate retail sales in the early 20th century? Well, AT&T basically had four different strategies. One was ruthless disintermediation. It went around wholesalers. At the time, the grocery business was very segmented into production, wholesaling, and retail distribution. A&P went right through the wholesalers, bought directly from suppliers, and therefore was able to undersell its smaller rivals. Second, A&P also spread throughout the country. It had hundreds of stores. It bought in bulk from producers. It was able to get enormous discounts from them. Third is vertical integration. A&P was not only a distributor, a retail seller of groceries, but it was also a manufacturer of groceries. It made butter. It made bread. It imported coffee. And it was also a great innovator. It may come as a surprise to some people to learn that there was a lot of innovation in the early 20th century in retail sales, but in fact there was. A&P learned how to cut costs out of the distribution system, but it also did something that foreshadows what internet companies today do, which is to use consumer data to make its operations more efficient and more receptive to the actual interests of consumers. So who benefited from all this? Well, consumers did. Who didn't benefit? Smaller competitors and the displaced middlemen that AT&T went around. And so the reason I'm going to talk about this case today is because it really does identify sort of an archetypal example of where a company, through competition, reduces the number of competitors, yet consumers are better off. So if we had an alternative standard called the competitive process standard, where would it leave us? Ultimately, I think that I'm going to defend the consumer welfare standard because I think it gives us a determinate objective that a more nebulous term like competitive process doesn't give us. So there were a number of quick legislative and prosecutorial reactions to A&P throughout the early and mid 20th century. I'm going to skip through a few of them just because we don't have a lot of time. I'm just going to briefly mention them. One is Congress in a variety of states imposed heavy taxes, not just on A&P, but also a lot of other large chain stores, so that they could be less successful in underselling smaller mom-and-pop businesses and other less efficient businesses. There is also the Robinson-Patman Act, whose mysteries I will not spend a lot of time on today. I still don't feel like I fully understand it, but one key to it is the original title of this act, which was the Wholesale Grocers Protection Act. And that is exactly what it was. It was designed to protect wholesalers and smaller retailers against large chain stores and often against the interests of consumers. All right, so now the main event of my presentation is the criminal prosecution of AMP by the Department of Justice. By the way, this is counting down from 2 minutes. All right, good. Okay, excellent. All right, so here's the main event. The main event is a criminal prosecution. People sometimes forget that the Sherman Act is a criminal statute and enforcement actions can be criminal today. We can find that to Section 1, but that wasn't always the case. And DOJ actually went after AMP, the corporation, and its key executives, including the two founders of the modern AMP, for criminal violations and secured felony convictions of them. What was the theory of criminal liability? Well, one was predatory pricing. The theory here was that AMP was pricing its goods too low and putting smaller, less efficient businesses out of the market. But there was never a clear distinction in DOJ's case between competitive pricing and predatory pricing. This is a problem that afflicted a lot of predatory pricing claims back in the early to mid-20th century. There were no determinative standards, so it ended up being sort of a know-it-when-I-see-it standard. What there is definitely not was anything comparable to what we would now call the recoupment requirement for plaintiffs. And here is a quote by Morris Edelman, roughly contemporaneous with the prosecution, that shows that you really kind of need to have a recoupment requirement in order to show why predatory pricing is a bad thing. Ultimately, the concern is that over the long run, consumers will have to pay more, will be worse off because of short-run price cuts. But that was never going to be a persuasive theory in the AMP case because there was no, because the entry barriers were sufficiently low. There was never a realistic scenario in which AMP was going to be able to hike its grocery prices to monopoly levels. Theory number two, DOJ brought. A monopsony theory. Here the theory was that AMP was getting such good deals from grocery suppliers that the suppliers got angry and turned around and raised the rates that they were charging all the independent grocery stores, the smaller ones. Now, this is perplexing from an economic perspective because presumably the suppliers were charging profit-maximizing rates for the smaller grocery stores in the first place, and it's unclear how it is that AMP was going to be, through its insistence on lower rates, was going to raise the costs of its rivals. DOJ never really tried to prove that. So instead of analysis, we ultimately had rhetoric. This is an actual quote from a prosecutor in the AMP case. It's amazing that you actually had prosecutors saying these things. AMP should be convicted of a criminal offense because it sells food cheaply to consumers in its own stores because it is a gigantic bloodsucker, taking its toll from all levels of the industry. Focus on other competitors in the industry rather than on the consumer beneficiaries of AMP's low prices. Third theory of liability was one of vertical integration. As I mentioned, AMP was an early vertical integrator. One of the vertically integrated companies with AMP was a company called ACCO, which was a purchasing agent. And what this company did is it went around the company and it bought fresh produce directly from farmers and other suppliers. Now, sometimes ACCO, this affiliate of AMP, bought too much produce and there was some leftover. What did AMP do? Well, it didn't throw the spare produce out. It sold it to other grocery stores, unaffiliated grocers. And obviously, it was going to sell the spare produce to those grocers at a profit, so it was charging them more than it charged itself when it sold the produce to the AMP retail stores. But obviously, the grocers, these independent grocers, didn't need to buy anything from the purchasing agent. They chose to because apparently the rates that ACCO was charging them were below the market rate. So AMP was effectively allowing its competitors to share in its economies of scale. But the linchpin of the case against AMP was that there was something really unseemly about doing business with your competitors, having companies that were simultaneously your competitors and your customers, and not treating them as customers as well as you treat your own operations. And you can see this in a variety of olfactory metaphors the district court thought were important to stress. It couldn't quite explain what was wrong about doing this, but it described these transactions as onerous and unjustified. So after DOJ has secured this criminal conviction of AMP and the and its executives, tried to break the company up in a civil suit that languished for a few years during a change of administration in the mid-20th century DOJ. Ultimately, that case settled. AMP had to spin off the purchasing agent, but otherwise the company remained solvent long enough for me to work for it as a bag boy in the 1980s. All right, I want to turn to a retrospective on this case that was published in the Yale Law Journal in 1949. That's a long time ago, 1949. Here are some of the quotes from this Yale Law Journal note. This is an economics professor at Yale who's getting his law degree at the same time and later went on to teach elsewhere. And I'm going to hold it as a mystery for a moment who it is. Here are some of the critiques he raised. The court never drew a clear line between predatory and competitive price cutting. Implied nonsensically that vertical integration was illegal per se, and no one ever made clear exactly, you know, when vertical integration would be a problem. The court's analysis also disregarded the dynamic nature of competition and the fact that competition is brutal and often puts companies out of business, but that's all in the interest of a competitive environment. And ultimately, the DOJ's decision to use the Sherman Act to go after AMP was an indication that there was a real contradiction in the way DOJ was using the antitrust laws. In other words, antitrust philosophy on display in the AMP case was a paradox, a policy at war with itself. So who wrote this 1949 Yale note? And this is a trick question. It was not Robert Bork. It was not anybody else from the Chicago School. It was a very young Don Turner, who ended up co-authoring the leading treatise with Phil Arita in antitrust, and who also ended up being the antitrust chief in the Lyndon Johnson administration, which not terribly known for its economic conservatism. This illustrates an important point, which is that the observations I just raised there about the need to distinguish between competitive and predatory price cuts, the need to understand the benefits of vertical integration, the need to understand that consumer-friendly competition often puts competitors out of business. Those are not new concepts that originated with Robert Bork or with the Chicago School in the 80s. These were well known to anyone who analyzed antitrust law in mid-century from the perspective of economics. All right, I have, and Derek has kindly told me that I can go a few minutes over. I'm going to contrast Don Turner's note with a more recent note that appeared in the Yale Law Journal by Lena Kahn, who's a very bright rising star in antitrust circles and is viewed properly as a leading light of the populist movement in antitrust. I'm going to express severe disagreement with her position on this set of issues. So Lena Kahn, in attacking internet giants, claims that we should dispense with the sort of Brook Group-oriented doctrinal distinction between competitive and predatory price cutting, and in particular, we should dispense with recoupment requirements for what she calls large platform providers. Instead, we should look at, you know, whether companies exploit their size, and we should look at the rich set of concerns that animated earlier critics of predation. Well, we looked at those rich set of concerns in the AMP case, and what we got instead of an analysis and a set of rules that companies know how to follow is rhetoric from a prosecutor. And my concern is that we're likely to see the same sort of rhetoric if we dispense with the consumer welfare orientation of antitrust today. In addition, Lena Kahn takes issue with Amazon's creation of a logistics empire to reduce delivery times. If you were able to get quick delivery from Amazon, it's in part because Amazon has built out a whole infrastructure of warehouses. But it doesn't hoard the scale economies of those warehouses to itself. It allows third-party merchants to avail themselves of those scale economies as well. And it actually reduces their costs. The third-party merchants who participate in Marketplace are able to reduce their shipping costs more than they would if they sought to deal with UPS and FedEx directly. So what's the problem? The problem is, according to this note, the conflicts of interest, tarnished neutrality. To me, those are words that outside the context of a fiduciary relationship aren't particularly persuasive. To me, the question is this the sort of behavior that makes consumers better off or worse off over the long run? And I've never heard, I've heard Carl and others give expositions of the raising rivals cost theory of antitrust, never heard a clear exposition of how lowering rivals costs is a basis for antitrust liability or why it should be. And this reminds me also of the attack on AMP's own purchasing agent, the theory that there's just something unseemly about doing business with your rivals. Okay, so imagine that Congress enacted a more populist vision of antitrust, and your job, like mine, is to answer calls from clients asking, well, what should we do about particular practices that we're considering? So suppose that you get a call from Apple back 10 years ago that said, you know, we have this really neat new device called the iPod and an application called the iTunes Music Store. We liked it. We'd like to launch it at a low price, but we're a little concerned that we're going to be so popular that we put Olson's Books and Records and other record stores out of business. In fact, they did. Should we launch it? Should we price the songs at a higher level that we view as profit maximizing because we want to cut Olson's Books and Record a break? Or what about Netflix? Netflix put Potomac Video out of business when it made use of more efficient distribution mechanisms to compete with local video stores. Amazon had a way to keep people, if they didn't want to buy physical books anymore, they didn't have to. They could buy Kindle, they could download books at a very low price onto the Kindle. That also is very bad for Olson's Books and Records, which, by the way, no longer exists, even though I liked it. And yet all of these are practices that we, I think we celebrate as a country because these are the source of disruptive economic developments that are extremely good for consumers and make America a global leader. So I'm going to skip right through this slide to go to one issue in particular that's been raised in some of the discussions, which is if we augment antitrust analysis beyond consumer welfare to look at other values, well, one of those other values, among a constellation of others like labor rights and campaign finance reform, should be whether antitrust enforcers should look at the political implications of particular conduct or political deals. So Tim Wu, in the materials that we circulated before this conference, has an interesting article in which he says, you know, does the enforcers should look at whether the complaint of conduct or merger tend to implicate important non-economic values, particularly political values. So might it tend to preserve a longstanding politically influential oligopoly? These are not issues today that are recognized under antitrust. What could go wrong if we added these to the antitrust analysis? Well, a president could go wrong. These are actual tweets or campaign statements by our nation's chief executive who views antitrust as a weapon to punish his political enemies and reward his political friends. He is very explicit about saying that he would block the NBC-Comcast merger mainly because NBC is liberal, but he would approve the Sinclair merger with Tribune because they are conservative and America needs more conservative voices. Now the question is, do we want that sort of analysis explicit or even implicit in antitrust law? The consumer welfare standard, with its precise focus on standards and economics, insulates us from this sort of political influence. All right, I'm going to close now by noting that the first panel addressed really two quite distinct sets of issues which were often conflated, and I think Fiona pointed this out. There are one set of issues is how can we improve antitrust to make consumers better off than the current enforcement environment does? So are there particular issues within antitrust, like how to assess error costs, when to use bright-line rules versus the rule of reason, when should we deploy concentration presumptions, or should we change them in the horizontal merger context, how should we think about vertical integration, heard about that this morning, when should we supplement antitrust with sector-specific regulation, like FCC rules about horizontal concentration in media industries. Those are all useful debates for us to have. They are all within the rubric of the consumer welfare standard. And the populist movement that we see today is helpful in that it, I think, helps us think of new perspectives on this set of issues. What is not helpful is a request to move antitrust beyond what I think these three principles are in antitrust's current consensus, which is how do we use rigorous economic analysis to advance the interests of consumers in virtually all market settings, except for natural monopoly markets where you might want some degree of sector-specific regulation. Thank you.
Carl, you're up.
Good afternoon, everybody. Let's keep going here. Maybe shake a little bit, keep moving. I want to first thank Chairman Simons, really, for bringing in such a diverse set of voices into this debate. I just think what we saw this afternoon was impressive in that respect. And as an academic, I might be tempted to kind of get into some of these arcane or philosophical or historical debates, but actually I'm a practitioner too, so I want to be very pragmatic. And the question is, how do we move forward to make antitrust more effective and stronger? And actually, we just heard, and we've heard on the earlier panel, let's distinguish making antitrust more effective and stronger on the one hand from what the standard should be. Now, they're related, but they're separate questions. Okay, now, I was asked, I guess this, the two of us here are supposed to be defending the consumer welfare standard, but I have a weird way of doing that, which is by proposing the protecting competition standard. Okay, now, it's, and by the way, the little copyright here is a joke, just to be clear. My point, and this you'll see this for the next few minutes, is that the consumer welfare standard, I think, as somebody said earlier, maybe it was Tim Wu, has been tainted and misused, in my view, to, was it Fiona? She's looking at me, Fiona Scott Morton. Tainted and misused to shrink back antitrust enforcement and has become confusing. So I think that we should jettison that language, but basically work with the fundamental idea. And that's what I'm doing here with being a little cute with the trademark, which is a fake, which is a joke, but protecting competition standard. As I head into that, I want to align myself, since we've already heard quite a bit on this, I want to align myself quite closely, particularly with Gene Kimmelman and Fiona Scott Morton from the earlier conversations, and to a considerable extent, that surprises me actually, in some respects, with Tim Wu as well, although not as wholly with him. Okay. I think the fundamental issue is that the case law has gotten out of whack using a kind of improper notion of consumer welfare standard, what that means, and we need to fix that, but not to fundamentally change the standard we use in antitrust. Okay, so what do I mean by the protecting competition standard? And just so it's clear, with the subtitle here, this is what I'm talking about here is in many ways what some people, including myself in the past, would call the consumer welfare standard, but in my view, done right and rebranded because it's tainted and confusing. Okay, so what do I mean by this? And this will echo my testimony in front of the Senate subcommittee on antitrust last December. So I'm just going to read it because this is important to everything that follows. A business practice is judged to be anti-competitive if it harms trading parties on the other side of the market as a result of disrupting the competitive process. And I want to put a lot of weight on disrupting the competitive process, okay, but that's a little bit unclear what that means and can be vague. So we really want to talk about harming the trading parties on the other side. Now, what are those trading parties? And by the way, John Sallet, I think earlier, had a very similar formulation and discussed some of these trading parties. So look, in the traditional cartel case, you've got gas stations colluding to raise the price of gas sold to motorists. That's consumers of the trading parties. We think about that. That's fine. But if we have jet fuel, if the suppliers of jet fuel are colluding to raise the price, well, the immediately injured parties are the airlines who buy the jet fuel. They're not consumers, okay? And to call them consumers would be confusing, okay? And nor should we have to ask, well, did the airlines pass it on, the jet fuel increase to consumers in order to decide whether that price fixing was bad or some other conduct? No, we don't. So if you want, so you don't need to trace to the final consumers. In that case, the trading parties are the customers, in the traditional formulation we have. Same with horizontal merger, right? If the airlines merge, we have the passengers. We understand that. If railroads merge, maybe they charge more for their passengers, but maybe they charge more for the farmers to move their produce, obviously particularly a late 19th century concern. In that case, we would think of the railroads as basically, or somebody, it's really akin to a monopsony power, right? The farmers only have one way to get their product to market. Okay, so we want to look upstream as well, and we have the no poach cases involving the workers where the DOJ went after it. So it's very clear, I think, from the actual case law and the enforcement and economics that the trading parties could be upstream or downstream. Okay, now it's true the focus has been more downstream, and that doesn't need to stay the case. But to fix that doesn't mean changing the standard; it just means bringing the cases if workers are hurt, okay, or farmers are hurt. And so we're good on that. Okay, again, the consumer welfare language is confusing, but in terms of the underlying economics, as Fiona Scott Morton said, we understand monopsony. That's fine. Okay, now I think here is where we start to engage a little bit with some of the things on the previous panel. In my view, and what I'm putting forward, the goal of antitrust law and policy. As an economist, I don't like to talk about what's the law or not, but I kind of stray into that. But the policy or the economic goals is to protect competition. Okay. Now, when I say protecting competition, it means safeguarding the competitive process. Now, we have to unpack that. What does that mean? Okay. And I would say it means that if firms are competing in some legitimately, we have to define that, we accept the results of that process. Okay. And if we think the outcome is not acceptable, there's a monopoly that's durable and we just can't live with, but that firm maybe got there through merits, then we need some sort of sector-specific regulation, okay? Now, this is not a Chicago school view. This is not a have to do with the, I don't think it's not about the consumer welfare standard. I'm going to take whatever it is, 1 minute of my time to read from what Judge Learned Hand said in the Alcoa case in the 40s, because I think it says it so well. And I just really don't think we want to depart from this. He said, a single producer may be the survivor out of a group of active competitors merely by virtue of his superior skill, foresight, and industry. In such cases, a strong argument can be made that, although the result may expose the public to the evils of monopoly, the act, the Sherman Act he's referring to, does not mean to condemn the result of those forces which it is its prime object to foster. Finis opus coronat. You can figure that out in Latin. The successful competitor, having been urged to compete, must not be turned upon when he wins. And I think your A&P case, of course, is very much, as you've described it, along those lines. Okay. So I really don't think it's a good idea. I think there'd be very limited support for the idea of abandoning that principle. Okay. Now, I think what you're hearing from Maurice Stuckey, for example, his lead bullet there was preservation of competitive market structures. Okay. Now, if you have a single firm gets big and gains a lot of share, maybe a monopoly position, through this process, without any question that they do it legitimately, you would not have a competitive market structure as you measured market shares. So that is a departure. That's a significant difference. I don't think we want to go there, but that's one of the issues potentially on the table. I think we want to live with the results of competition. And then, of course, enforce the anti-loss laws vigorously against to constrain such a monopolist, but not to break them up just because the market structure looks concentrated or is concentrated. Okay. Now, when we follow this approach, the structuring of the inquiry, we ask, so I said, whether trading partners have been harmed as a result of conduct that disrupts the competitive process. So we're thinking about the trading parties. We're not particularly concerned, per se, if the competitors are injured, and that's become a mantra. And we're not saying there's anything wrong with being big. Okay. Now, if you don't agree with that, then you're in a different space. Then you're not protecting competition. You're doing some other social policy. I don't think that should be antitrust role, but that's one of the things potentially to be the debate. I think this gives coherence to what we're talking about. And how would I illustrate that? So let's just go through a few examples. And I think, by the way, we all want to move this debate forward, and I certainly hope the FTC, as they take all of us on board, is instead of talking about disruptive competitive processes, let's talk about specific fact patterns to see where there's a difference between what the different people are saying. So take horizontal price fixing. Okay, that disrupts the competitive process. They raise price. They're not competing. That harms the customers. Clear. What about standard setting? It's an agreement among competitors. They agree to produce products that meet a certain standard. People who produce non-compliant products, it's not going to be commercially attractive. It reduces choice. How do we choose between those two? I mean, why is standard setting not per se illegal? right? It's an agreement, has all these features. It sounds like it disrupts the competitive process. They don't compete with all these incompatible products. Well, how do we tell? We say, well, we actually think, in most cases, the standard setting leads to consumer benefits, a larger market, lower prices, you know, other benefits of compatibility. So that's how we tell. Okay, we tell by looking at how does it affect the trading parties, not through just some notion of the process. Likewise, for horizontal mergers, we don't think just because two firms that are competitors merge and they don't compete anymore, the market's more concentrated, but we don't say that's per se illegal because we understand there may be some efficiencies associated with that. How do we judge? Well, we ultimately look at the effect on the customers in any event, for the normal downstream posture. And likewise, for predatory pricing, as has been explained, we need a boundary between what's legitimate price competition that we welcome and some sort of predatory or exclusionary price fixing. Now, the courts have come up with a standard through Brook Group, and it involves below cost and recoupment. I tend to think that recoupment piece is overstated, and I think that could be worked on, probably should be worked on. But the notion that we need a boundary, and ultimately it's really about, do we think this is going to harm the customers? You know, from ultimately high prices later or less innovation or not? And I don't really want to not do that step, okay? Otherwise, I don't know how I'm going to have a boundary between legitimate pricing and not. The Microsoft case we heard about is a very good case. There was discussion about it earlier. Again, the reason we evaluate that based on, do we think that was going to reduce innovation? Believe me, that's not about price effects. It was never really about price effects. And you couldn't do price effects for some product that wasn't going to be out there for a few years. But it came out in a good way. Okay, all right. So I think this trading parties and disrupting the competitive process, both of those pieces are needed with whatever you call the standard. I'm calling that the protecting competition standard. Okay, so let's then compare that with some of the attacks on the consumer welfare standard, which we've just heard. Okay, and again, I want to, particularly Tim, who I thought saw it very eloquently. Look, the way the courts and cases have evolved over the last 20, 30, 40 years has shrunken antitrust enforcement, and it's a problem. And Fiona Scott Morton said we have more issues about market power. I agree with both of those statements, but I do not think it means we need to abandon this mode of analysis. In fact, I think we should not. So what are the criticisms? First, some of them are based on misconceptions. It's not, the consumer welfare standard is not just about price or short run. And doesn't ignore the suppliers. We have the no-poach cases and so the case law. It's just a misconception. Now, there's a reason that misconception has taken root, because the word consumer welfare standard sounds like it's about consumers. It gets people confused. That's why I think we need to change the language, okay? You can't expect the people, the community at large to know that that somehow when you say consumer welfare, you include the workers who didn't have a good chance to shop or to get competition for employment opportunities. It sure doesn't sound like it handles that. Why would we think people should know that? So there's a real problem there with the words and the branding, if you will. Some criticisms, most of the criticisms actually relate to excessive burdens of proof on plaintiffs. So, you know, in every area, and a lot of what Maurice Stuckey is putting forward with some proposed legislative changes, I think basically all of those, or almost all of those, the ones that anyhow work for me, are their excessive burdens on the plaintiffs. Look, you cannot, and if it means the economists are coming into court and have to prove the measure of these price effects and sometimes in the future or new products, that's very hard. Believe me, I've been cross-examined on those things. We're not able to do that a lot of the time. Okay, so if inability to do that means the plaintiff loses, we're not in the right place. Okay, so we can do a lot with shifting the burdens of proof and the presumptions. I'm gonna talk about that in a moment. So that's a legitimate, I think, very important concern about the evolution of the case law, but it's not about the standard. Okay, take the standard, rebrand it, give it a name that people understand, and tighten things up. Now, whether the current courts are going to do that, I'm not so confident, but that's what hopefully the FTC, based on these hearings, can help push us in that direction. Okay. All right. Now, the same point in a different way. I think most people who are informed would say that antitrust was not in good balance in the 60s. Okay, the economics was not that sound, and there was a bunch of cases that, and A&P in the 50s, I guess, as well. So there were needed corrections, And it's true, it came around the same time, some of it, as this upsurge of the consumer welfare standard. But and I think the court's overshot, like I've said. But to fix that, we should fix that with, you know, with through the approaches I've described, not by throwing out the standard and doing something either vague or that doesn't have the elements I've described, which is disrupting the competitive process, harming trading parties. Also, economics, some people who are attacking the consumer's welfare standard basically, well, it's a plot by these economists love to measure things, and it's kind of these experts who miss the point. Look, economics is just a tool. And if anybody thinks you can do antitrust with without economics, come talk to me later. Okay. So, all right, so what does it mean going forward? I think there's a lot of work in economics going on right now, the last couple of years, and I'm sure the next several years, in my field, industrial organization economics, in academics, researchers, and elsewhere, that is indeed showing, I would say, generally, that larger companies have a bigger share of the economy. Firm size has gone up. A bunch of markets have become more concentrated. It's hard to measure that systematically, but that seems to be the case. Some very efficient superstar firms, they're called in some of the literature, are taking share from other firms. They're becoming geographically broader. Globalization is part of this. That is a process that has been going on for some time and probably will continue unless it's stopped through some public policies. So what does that mean? Does that mean that antitrust has failed us? No, I don't think so. A lot of that, and Amazon's a good example, sure looks to be the competitive process at work. Not all of it, you have to look case by case, but a lot of those trends are broad and they reflect scale economies, information technology, and one of the things that the industrial organization economists have learned in the last 10 or 15 years that many of you may not know is there's just tremendous evidence that in a given industry, there's enormous variation in the efficiency of the firms. Okay, so if you have this model about, oh, all the firms compete and it's Darwinian and they all end up, you know, roughly comparable, that is not what happens in the real world. You get enormous variation and that persists. And the more efficient firms tend to get bigger. And that's just an ongoing process. So that process means when we get some markets that are more concentrated through that competitive process, we're going to also be getting, that is in fact benefiting consumers. And we want to encourage it, actually. Okay, although it's tough on the people who are on the firms who are less efficient, to be sure. So all that's happening, that means we need antitrust more. Okay, the fact is, it means there's more market power in the economy. That's what the evidence is showing. Higher margins, we debate about how to measure that. More concentrated markets. Entry barriers can be very difficult. If you're trying to enter a market where there are three or four big players who've been in there for a long time and they're very efficient, that's pretty tough. You're small, you haven't done it. That's tough, okay? So the notion that entry barriers are somehow generally low, I don't think that's a valid assumption. So we need antitrust more, okay? But that doesn't mean we need a new standard. It means we need antitrust more. So how should we do that? So, of course, I'm suggesting the protecting competition standard. And again, it's the consumer welfare standard done right with a better name. And I think the FTC can play a big role in this, okay? And I hope that that's the lesson they will take from these hearings, is that we need antitrust more. An overly narrow reading of consumer welfare and excessive burdens on plaintiffs have shrunken antitrust in a way that's not been helpful for consumers or other parties who are suffering from market power on the other side of the market. In horizontal mergers, we can do this by making sure we keep and strengthen the Philadelphia National Bank structural presumption, and plus a few other things. Merger, it's a predictive exercise. If the consumer welfare standard is supposed to mean that you have to go in and precisely predict exactly what the price effects will be, well, that's not going to be very good for effective enforcement, but that's not what the standard should mean. Standard should mean you're looking at, is it likely that there will be harm to competition and the customers, in the normal case, will be hurt? Is it likely, based on the best you can tell? Maybe it'll be fewer products offered. Maybe it'll be higher prices. Maybe it'll be something else. Maybe it'll be less privacy protection for, whatever it is. So you can't predict things precisely. We can use some other metrics to gauge things, not just herfindahls. And I think we should be quite demanding on an entry defense, because a lot of markets, entry is not easy, and we shouldn't just think it is. Okay, so that should be really a burden on the defense. unless it's very clear, to show that entry's easy, okay? And we've had that debate for a while. I think we need to move things in that direction. That's all within the consumer welfare or protecting competition standard. Exclusionary conduct, again, the courts, you know, have trimmed it back so much. These pay-for-delay cases should not be so hard, okay? The economics is not that complicated. So something's gone wrong, that it's been 20 years and it's still working its way through and the courts are struggling with it. And, you know, I've talked to a number of federal judges about this, and it's hard. You know, the agencies need to help them, the economists need to help them, but it's not about a different standard. And we could do similarly talk about how to, what to do for exclusive dealing. Okay, so I think that's really, that's what I'm encouraging the FTC to take away from this session and these hearings today at least, this afternoon at least, that don't blow up what we've learned, including the A&P case, including a lot of other things. Don't blow that up, build on that, and do more, because we need to do more now, but use the protecting competition standard. Thank you.